ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Every time we make life easier, we give something away. A click here, a quick login there. Convenience has a price. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I explore what we trade for comfort online and how to take some of it back. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, Anthony Fennell here. This is Future Tense on ABC Radio National and the first in our Australian summer series of highlight programs. Some of our favourites from the past year and a bit. Now, I should just mention right up front that we've decided to jazz up the name of the show just for this week. So, goodbye Future Tense and hello, Whatever Happened To? And what is Whatever Happened To all about? Well, it's about catching up on those ideas, projects that once attracted considerable media attention and were certain to play an important part in the future. On the show today, Hyperloops, Solar Roads, Google Glass and space tourism. Now, to jazz things up a bit, I've decided to use a Wheel of Future Fortune to choose the running order. So here we go. And our first choice today is Solar Roads. Here's Sarah Marquardt, editor of the blog From Quarks to Quasars.
The idea really took shape in 2014. That's when it gained this widespread attention. And that was because of two folks named Scott and Julie Bursaw. And they were the founders of a company appropriately named Solar Roadways. And they, in 2014, launched this crowdfunding project or the crowdfunding campaign for their project. And it was accompanied by this YouTube video, and the video was titled Solar Freaking Roadways. And it just went viral.
Solar Freaking Roadways.
What are they?
They're solar freaking roadways.
What do they want from me?
Well, they're solar freaking roadways.
Okay, so actually this time, what is it? It's technology that replaces all roadways, parking lots, sidewalks, driveways, tarmacs, bike paths, and outdoor...
It went on to garner more than 22 million views, and they raised $2.2 million USD. And that's really when all of these outlets started reporting about solar roadways, because the promises in the video, I mean, they were fantastic.
They generate electricity, they generate capital, they pay for themselves, and they keep paying more because we're not going to run out of sun for like 15 billion years. That lowers the cost.
And the long-term goal was really straightforward. Replace all the roadways, driveways, bike paths, basketball courts, tarmacs, everything with solar panels instead of asphalt. But these weren't just regular solar panels. They were these smart, interlocking, hexagonal-shaped solar panels, and they were also made out of recycled materials. And the pros, according to the company, were seemingly endless. You know, they could supposedly produce three times our annual energy consumption by converting this existing road network into solar roadways. Electric vehicles could be charged simply by driving on them. Panels would be impact resistant, eliminating the need for road repairs. And then they also would be heated. So in areas with snow, ice, it would eliminate that issue of shoveling. And, you know, it continues. They said that they could embed LED lights in these panels so that instead of painted road lines, we would have LEDs. The panels were also supposedly going to be pressure sensitive, so they could detect if an animal was crossing the road in front of you and give a timely warning. And then the other big piece that they were offering is that each panel would also have this corridor integrated into the design, and that would essentially be an area where telephone wires, all these different cables that are currently on poles and wires hanging, those would all be inside these corridors now. And the corridors would also help manage stormwater. Oh, and also they're going to create all these jobs. That's a lot. And it really sounded too good to be true. And that's because it was in 2014 and it still is in 2024.
So the answer to Whatever Happened to Solar Roads, which we featured on Future Tense several times over the years, is sadly not a lot. So what went wrong?
So a few of them have been installed around the world, and some of them worked better than others. But as a whole, they just did not generate much electricity compared to what was expected. France first unveiled their solar road in 2016. It was 1 kilometer. It was meant to generate enough electricity to power streetlights in a nearby town. But by 2018, the road was already deteriorating. 90 meters of it had to be demolished. Big issue was cracks in the panels, rotting leaves, and also just a lack of sun in the region. So they ended up generating maybe about half the energy that they were hoping for, a little less than half. And just the road was just really destroyed by wear and tear. The speed limit had to be reduced significantly as well. And eventually, the company behind the road just admitted that, you know, the project will not be moving forward anymore. So that one doesn't exist. China also had a promising installation originally. It was also a 1 kilometer test road. The goal was that it would produce about 1 gigawatt of energy every year and power about 800 homes. The beginning, again, there was a lot of excitement and everything, but just 5 days after the road opened in 2017, a panel went missing. A bunch of the surrounding panels were damaged, so just no updates after that point.
So durability was an issue. What about the solar side of solar roads? Tell us about that.
So essentially, the issue with solar roads is that they are just simply not efficient. And it's really all about the angles. So on a traditional solar farm, solar panels are angled toward the sun to maximize efficiency. More advanced solar farms also have panels that are made to track the sun. A typical solar panel can utilize up to 20% of the energy that the sun produces. So that's pretty optimal. But solar roadways lay flat, and that minimizes the panel's exposure to direct sunlight. Then you add in the leaves, the debris, the dirt. A flat solar panel will result in about 60% less power in comparison to direct sunlight. And then the thickness of the panel itself, you know, you want the panel to be thick enough to withstand being driven over, but too thick, and then the light does not efficiently get into it. Just in general, even in the best conditions, the panels are already at a disadvantage because of the angle.
So let's go to the costing side of all of this and return on investment. What can you tell us there?
The cost is so significant compared to the return that we're getting, because you have to consider the construction, the cost of maintenance, the cost of materials, the cost of research and development. Again, thinking about these claims that, you know, these solar roadways would produce 3 times more electricity than the annual power consumption in the United States. That sounds great, but that does not factor in the cost of such an astronomical project. You know, looking back at the example that we were talking about in France, it was about $5.2 million for just a 1 kilometer stretch of road. And again, the amount of energy it was producing was about half of what it was expected. So really, the investment, it's not giving us that ROI, especially compared to things like solar farms. And then you factor in the idea that originally these panels, it was promised that they would last 10 to 20 years, but they're deteriorating so quickly. You know, different researchers are looking at sort of advanced polymers to use to construct the panels as well to protect them. But those polymers are expensive to manufacture. And then when you really dig deep into it, the material is also typically made from fossil fuels. So it really defeats the purpose of using the solar panels to reduce the carbon footprint.
Sarah Marquardt there, and the unrealized ambition of solar roads. Next up, Google Glass. The wearable smart glasses with a built-in camera and a computer screen in one lens.
Here are the basics of how to use glass. This is your touchpad. It runs from your temple to your ear. Tap the touchpad to wake up glass.
They were launched a decade ago, but failed to capture the public imagination. They were then updated and relaunched in 2019, and now Google no longer offers support for the technology. So even if you still have a pair, they're pretty worthless. Journalist and author Quinn Myers describes Google Glass as both a cautionary tale and a punchline.
Well, I guess first, the cautionary tale is just the way Silicon Valley or the tech industry operates in a way that, you know, they sort of pursue what they want to pursue regardless of what people want or need. And you know, until I guess in the case of Google Glass, the shareholders eventually stepped in and said, like, why are you pouring so much money into this? And as a punchline, it was kind of a different side of that coin, which was that people saw Google pursuing this and they saw what Google wanted people to think it was, but the reality of the situation was so much different. And I think it kind of revealed the arrogance of Google at the time. And eventually people just laughed at it because, you know, when it came out, it didn't really work. You know, the batteries got hot. It was priced at $1,500, which was exorbitant compared to phones and stuff like that. Google was sure that they were going to replace iPhones, that this was the next big thing, but it fell wildly short of that goal. And everyone just kind of saw that they didn't accomplish that and laughed and basically kind of laughed at them.
And worse for the company, it was seen by many people as creepy, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The camera really worried people. There's fears about facial recognition. The idea that people could be recording you at any time. You think about when you're in public on the train or something and someone has their camera out and if you knew they were recording you or could record you kind of surreptitiously, you would be a little more buttoned up. You wouldn't act normal. And Glass threatened to just kind of do that on a widespread scale. And I don't think that was something Google really reckoned with before they came out with it.
Now, Google Glass is a footnote in history, but for quite a few years there, it was predicted to be the future of the internet. Lots of people got very excited about it, particularly tech journalists and people in the tech industry. Just remind us how much money and effort the company poured into that project, because it was quite substantial, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yes. They had not really branched into physical products yet, and this was their first one. They not only wanted it to be like their marquee product, but this was going to potentially replace phones, maybe computers. Their idea was like a single screen life was what they are aiming for. They poured untold billions of dollars into this, working on it in their secret lab in Mountain View or marketing. The marketing was wild for Google Glass because they needed it to succeed.
Now, here's the thing that really surprised me. And it comes through very clearly in your book that right from the beginning, there was all this hype, as you say, associated with the development of Glass. But what was surprising was that the company had never really worked out what its marketable function was. So they'd never really worked out a business model for the technology. How did that happen?
So in part, it was that when Google Glass first came out, it was a beta product. And the idea behind this was that they would beta test it in real life, just like they do with their software. You know, Gmail was a beta that only a few people had at first. They figured out how people used it, what the bugs were, and then they released it to everybody. Glass was supposed to be the same thing, but software and hardware are different, was one of their lessons. But they also then marketed it as a finished product. So people, you know, when it was a beta product and people didn't really know what it was for or what to use it for, that caused a lot of confusion and just consternation over this. At the same time, there wasn't really a leading utility for Glass. They pitched it as something that you would just wear all the time. You would get text, emails, you would record videos, you could take pictures, you could post to social media. It was supposed to be your phone on your face. But that didn't work out as well because people are used to using their phones. Everyone is pretty good at that stuff on their phones. It's nice. You can put it away in your pocket. So transitioning to a whole new technology that works with your life in a different way was a huge hurdle. And I think without a leading utility that said, Glass does this head and shoulders above your phone, whether it was pictures or videos or anything, they couldn't say that. And without that kind of leading utility, there wasn't anything to get people to kind of like try it out or start wearing it in the first place.
Quinn Myers, author of the book Google Glass, and a reminder perhaps that even the really big tech players, the incredibly successful ones, sometimes get it wrong. Which leads us nicely to our third selection. Whatever happened to the Hyperloop?
Have you ever wondered what the future of transportation might look like? Picture a world where long-distance travel is no longer a time-consuming affair, thanks to the revolutionary concept of the Hyperloop. Proposed by Elon Musk, the Hyperloop is a futuristic transportation system where passenger pods zip through...
It works very similar to, you know, a century-old technology, which is pneumatic tubes.
Andrew Hawkins, transportation editor for The Verge.
You take a tube, you suck a lot of the air out of that tube, you create something close to a vacuum, and then the theory is that you can propel a pod with passengers in it or cargo or any sorts of things through that tube at ultrasonic speeds. I've seen theories of close to 700 to 800 miles per hour.
So there was a lot of hype, wasn't there, when it was first launched, and helped by the fact that Elon Musk was one of the first to get really excited about it and really start putting money into the project.
Yeah, that's a real great way of putting it. It was back in 2013 that Musk really laid out his vision for this underground Hyperloop tunnel system that was sort of capable of using magnetic levitation to really shorten people's commutes, essentially, to shorten the amount of time that it took to travel between various cities. He theorized that you could get between Los Angeles and San Francisco in under 30 minutes. He also said the same for New York and Washington, D.C. And that really sparked a lot of people's imaginations. The technology seemed to be sound, and all it was really going to take was, you know, sort of someone with the business vision and with a lot of money, obviously, to put it into reality. But unfortunately, that was not the case.
And a clarification at this point. Elon Musk might have kicked things off, but he didn't personally get involved in running a Hyperloop operation. The big player in the Hyperloop stakes was the now defunct firm called Hyperloop One, which was eventually bought by Richard Branson of Virgin Airlines fame.
They got started pretty quickly with a lot of venture capital money, a lot of investment. They put on some pretty flashy demonstrations of the technology. And it seemed like if any of these companies were going to actually make the Hyperloop a reality, it could be this company, Hyperloop One.
There's two engineering challenges, really, aren't there, with this? There's how do you move these small pods through the tube in a safe way and fast enough to make it seem worthwhile to those wanting to use this form of transportation or indeed invest in it? There's also the construction of the tubes themselves. Could I get you to just tell us a little bit about that? How are they going to do it? And were they going to be underground? Were they going to be above ground? What was the planning there?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. There's a number of engineering challenges as well as policy and regulatory challenges. But the idea was that you could either sink these tubes underground, so it would work somewhat similar to a subway system, or you could put them above ground, perhaps on some sort of pylons, and maybe run it alongside a highway or rail tracks along those lines. But unfortunately, it was just, you know, sort of got bogged down in a lot of these complications. And so Hyperloop One, as well as several other of these startups that were trying to turn Hyperloop into a reality, realized that it was going to take more than just excitement and investment, that they would actually have to sort of get involved in land use and a variety of other sort of logistical requirements around infrastructure. How are you going to maintain a vacuum, for example, in, you know, tubes that were hundreds of miles long was another problem that they were facing. How would the pods turn at these high speeds if they had to go into some sort of banked turn? For example, there was concerns about safety, whether or not people would be actually safe riding through these tunnels. So there was just, you know, sort of a host of infrastructure and logistical challenges that really ultimately led to the demise of this. And I would also just like to note that this is just one of those ideas, especially in the United States, that seemed born out of a zero interest rate environment, that when there was just no interest rates and lots of investment money flowing, it seemed like anything was possible at that time. But then as soon as the pandemic happened and then interest rates started to creep up as a result of inflation, you saw a lot of these investments start to fall by the wayside and people realizing that they were not actually possible anymore in sort of the present economic climate.
As I understand it, there are still some Hyperloop projects operating around the world, in Europe, also in China. Are they serious or are they small scale? What can you tell us about them?
They're pretty small scale, but they say that they're serious. There was a company called Hyperloop that successfully managed to demonstrate some of its technology. They used magnetic levitation to lift a pod up into the air and guide it smoothly through a tube that's, I think, around 90 meters and about 420 meters long. And it did it in about 18 miles per hour. So obviously much slower than the proposed 600 to 700 miles per hour goal that was outlined by Musk and others. But it does seem to me that, you know, if you, with enough, you know, money and a little bit of ingenuity that some of these companies are able to actually put some of these demonstrations in place, whether or not that actually leads then to the next step of receiving more investment and more interest. And then obviously what we talked about previously, being able to clear some of these regulatory and logistical hurdles and meet all of these sort of land use requirements and other things. That's a different story altogether, but there are still a number of firms that are trying to test this out. You know, the one that I referenced is at a Hyperloop center in the Netherlands. I think that there are a few others in Spain as well. So the dream is not entirely dead. It still lives on, it seems, in some of these places.
Well, Andrew Hawkins, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And you're listening to Future Tense on ABC Radio National Summer. I'm Anthony Fennell. I mentioned Richard Branson's involvement in Hyperloop One earlier. And Branson also features in our fourth and final look at a project or technology that once seemed so promising, but has now largely fallen off the radar.
ECS check 204.
Minus 10, our final nine, whatever happened to eight, is space seven, tourism. Six, and here to update us is astrophysicist three, Paul Sutter.
It turns out that getting into space is kind of hard, and building rockets is easier said than done. So it does require an enormous investment of money. And with the advent of private spaceflight, we saw that this private money wasn't coming from established existing corporations. What we saw was the rise of billionaires who became very interested and passionate in their own spaceflight adventures.
Is it right to say that their personalities influence the way space tourism as a concept developed?
Yes, because you have, especially if we rewind the clock to 10 or 15 years ago, these seem like eccentric billionaires or a little bit of cowboy atmosphere, a little Wild West where you have like Elon Musk, you know, hot on the tails of the successes with Tesla. You have Jeff Bezos, you know, with the, you know, this gigantic monolith that is now Amazon. And then you have Richard Branson, who just have tons of money and a vision, something a lot of us have been passionate about and interested about since we were kids.
I know there has been criticism that their approach was really a billionaire's toys approach to the whole concept.
Yeah, it is a fair criticism. And now, after the private spaceflight industry has matured somewhat, it turns out tickets are obscenely expensive. And that these wealthy individuals who have developed these programs, it hasn't really realized that dream or that implicit promise that access to space would become cheaper and more widely available. It has been still restricted, even though after years of development, to the ultra-wealthy class.
And how many tourists have, in fact, visited space via one of these three companies?
By far, the most common avenue for getting into space is through Richard Branson's company, Virgin Galactic. And several dozen individuals have made it to space. And of all the companies, Virgin Galactic does offer the cheapest ride. It's somewhere around $400,000 to $500,000 for a ticket. However, of the potential offerings of these companies, this is by far the least impressive. These are flights that take you up just past the von Karman line. This is an imaginary line, an imaginary altitude, 100 kilometers up, that is internationally agreed upon to be the edge of space. You know, there's no like real boundary there. There's no line there. But that's just, we all kind of agree that's roughly when you can count yourself as having gone into space. And so if you get a ride on Virgin Galactic, the whole flight lasts several hours, but you'll only spend a few minutes above this von Karman line, technically being in space. And so while that is the vast majority of rides into space with private individuals, it also like barely counts.
That doesn't sound like what you would expect when you hear the concept of space tourism. One would imagine that you're up there somewhere near the moon.
Exactly. If you just talk to someone and say, hey, would you like to go into space? You think of like the astronauts in the International Space Station. You think of orbiting the Earth. You think of a journey, an extended stay in space, not a quick suborbital hop.
So the space tourism industry hasn't panned out the way that it was expected. Do we know how much investment has flowed into the actual development of these space programs over the last decade and a half?
Since these are all private companies, they do not have to disclose their finances to the public, but it is on the order of tens, if not hundreds of billions of dollars of investment into the private spaceflight industry. With that said, two of the companies, SpaceX and Blue Origin, SpaceX led by Elon Musk and Blue Origin led by Jeff Bezos, their stated goal is not space tourism. For them, space tourism is a nice little side hustle. They're more interested in developing lift capabilities, industrial capabilities in space. Virgin Galactic is the only company with the stated goal of space tourism, where that is their main line of income. I have no idea how much of Richard Branson's fortune he spent on developing Virgin Galactic, but I'm sure it's eye-watering.
So the space tourism industry, for all the money and effort spent so far, isn't likely to rival the cruise industry anytime soon. But the companies involved claim that what they do isn't just about joyrides. They say it's also about conducting experiments in space. So how much research have they done?
It's not a lot. It's honestly not a lot. With the Virgin Galactic, the vast majority of space tourism flights, there's no research happening. You're not going to get any significant amount of research done in a few minutes. There have been some limited tests and experiments done with the Blue Origin launches. But again, those Blue Origin launches, those only spent like an hour or two in space before coming back down to Earth. The company that provides the greatest opportunity to be in space is SpaceX, because of those three companies, they're the only ones with the capabilities to actually send you into orbit, which means you don't just get to space, you can stay in space. And there have been legitimate science experiments performed by private astronauts on board privately funded space missions. The most recent one is the Polaris Dawn mission, which was funded by another billionaire, Jared Isaacman. And in their experiment, they were actually able to send a SpaceX capsule to an incredibly high orbit, the highest orbit since the Gemini program that led to the Apollo missions. And they spent several days in space. They actually had many spacewalks. They carried a bunch of experiments with them, exploring the interaction between human bodies and health and a microgravity environment. So that's great. Yay, science. Yay, research. I'm all a fan of that. But if you look at the decades of research that government agencies have been doing on spaceflight, the effects of spaceflight on humans, it's honestly a drop in the bucket.
And where is the industry at the moment? Those three big players, are they all still actively seeking space tourists, or have they backed off a bit?
Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic is still actively seeking tourists, and flights go up regularly. You can book a reservation now. Blue Origins, they have instead pivoted most of their efforts to the research side and delivering some NASA contracts for a lander for the upcoming return to the moon. And then SpaceX, it is available. It is by far the most expensive option because it is a much more capable spacecraft. It is a much longer stay in orbit. So it's not exactly, you can't go on I want to go to space.com and buy a ticket. You have to have many discussions with SpaceX, with NASA involved, in order to build that private space flight program that you have your eyes set on.
Astrophysicist and NASA advisor Paul Sutter, completing our look at four technologies that promise so much but didn't or haven't yet lived up to their future promise. You've been listening to Future Tense. The producer for this program was Karin Zsivanovits. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.